Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, my guest today is Joseph Galliano, the co-founder and CEO of Queer Britain, the charity working to complete the nation's family tree by establishing the UK's first LGBTQ plus museum. Set to be the largest of its kind in the world, the museum will reflect every race, gender, and orientation under the LGBTQ plus umbrella in a bid to preserve histories that have been ignored or destroyed, or as Jay says, before it's too late. A place to tell the stories of the people that mattered in the fight for equality while offering a shared space to come together and learn more. Joe, welcome to Changemakers. Tell us a little bit more about Queer Britain.
Thank you, Michael. Well, Queer Britain is a charity working to make sure that LGBTQ plus people's place in the culture is really restored to where it should be. We've got this kind of missing tooth in the British cultural landscape, which is very patchily filled in. And we want to make sure that we're uplifting LGBTQ plus people's stories and queer people's stories for everybody, because these stories aren't just about LGBTQ plus people. They are for everybody and about everybody, because we're all part of that same family.
Well, I want to get on to, because I love this phrase, like completing the nation's family tree. But before we do that, let's go into the identity. Queer Britain, reclaiming a word that many would say has got derogatory connotations. Tell us a little bit about the thinking of the queer in Queer Britain.
Well, that's exactly right, isn't it? And actually, it is wanting to be part of that conversation, wanting to be part of taking that last bit of sting, which is particularly held by some older people who really were kicked around with that word, and actually saying, actually, it's a word that can be celebrated, and because we, by taking back ownership of it. It's also the most inclusive word under the LGBTQ plus moniker, because we couldn't call ourselves lesbian Britain. We couldn't call ourselves transgender Britain. But there's a place for everybody under the sort of plasticity of queer.
But it's a word that, I mean, you know, I think you and I are roughly the same vintage age-wise, but I mean, queer was a word that growing up was seen as cruel, wicked, nasty, hurtful. Yet today it feels like it has been totally changed in terms of its role in identity. And I guess You're reflecting that with the new museum.
Well, it's interesting the way that language kind of changes and evolves and how it reflects different kinds of power bases. I mean, if we think about a word like gay, which was a word that we actively used to create something positive about ourselves in terms of identity. You go into schools anytime in the last sort of 10 years, and that's become one of the most vicious insults that could be thrown around, and one of the most hurtful insults that could be thrown around. And so, you know, whatever we try and do with language, it will change and evolve and mean different things at different times. And so we embrace it in a celebratory way, and, you know, also to try and create some of the space to really take that hurt out of it. And I think that's really important for us.
As you know, Mark Gatiss is the second interview that accompanies this episode. And I would say that if I took one lesson from that interview, it was listening to the master storyteller at work. In terms of storytelling in the role of the new museum, I mean, is that what it's about? Is it telling the story of our times?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's telling the stories of individuals and how those individuals sat within wider communities. But it's also like, I mean, the thing that hasn't been recognized widely enough is when we think about the oversized impact that LGBTQ plus people have had on society in relation to the their size in the population. It's quite extraordinary. When you think we've shortened wars, we've launched world-class companies, we've probably had more impact on arts and culture than almost any other sets of communities. And yet it's not really been celebrated in this broad way within the sort of the heart of the mainstream.
And I suppose that is a story of achievement and ambition, but
in the face of stigma.
Well, let's get on to the stigma in a moment. But I also thought that there was something also quite gentle about this as well. I mean, I read something that you had said, which was that I'd really like the museum to be somewhere where if a young woman has just come out to her mother, they can go together so they can both understand a bit more about each other. I mean, it's a place of understanding as well, isn't it?
And inclusion for all. You know, we want that mother to feel just as welcome and just as much a part of the story as the daughter does.
Mm. I mean, and quite often that coming out moment is a moment that lives long in the memory, either as a point of great pain or indeed points of great humour, as Mark was telling me. But I mean, in terms of the museum and its role in that particular chapter in a person's life, tell us more.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, speaking as an enthusiastic homosexual of a certain age, you know, I know that whenever gay men, certainly speaking as a gay man, whenever gay men get together, they do tend to show each other their coming out battle scars, and that is the one you can guarantee people are going to talk about.
What was yours, Jay?
Well, like most gay men, it wasn't one thing or another. You know, it was about rupture with family that was then mended as a result of the coming out. It was coming out to my family, to my mother at sort of 15, and then going back into the closet in terror, coming out again when I left for university, again, being a slow process, a slow and nervous process. But actually, it still happens sort of every day. You know, it happens when you have to make that decision in a shop, when somebody said, oh, your wife's going to like that. And you have to make that decision, right? Oh, is this the right moment to out myself here? Because do I have a responsibility? Do I feel comfortable enough?
Do you feel comfortable? And do you feel the need to mold yourself to situations? I mean, I read something that you said here that people came out of their closets. Now it's time to come out of the margins. In terms of, you know, the role of your life today, in terms of, the role of the new museum and how you hope it to help everyone, really. I mean, tell us more about that journey, that mission, if you will, in terms of what might come next.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, I'm very keen of holding a personal responsibility to people who aren't as lucky as my life has been. You know, okay, I was a former editor of Gay Times magazine. I've worked in senior business, LGBTQ plus networking, that sort of authentic leadership space piece. And there's no going back in the closet for me. And I have been I'm as out as it's possible to be. Mm. I had a moment actually a few years back. I was buying a bottle of wine actually to take back to my husband who'd been working his arse off all day, and the woman in the shop said, "Oh, your wife will be pleased." I think as I mentioned there, and I had this kind of quite profound moment of crisis in that moment where I just felt like, well, do I say nothing, which feels like it's letting my other half down. And if I'm standing here flushing and uncertain how to respond to that without also, you know, being aggressive, she didn't mean any harm by what she said. But I also thought, well, what happens if there's a 16-year-old standing there who hasn't had the life journey I've had?
So what did you do?
Well, I just said that I think I just held a bottle of wine up and went, "Husband." And she, of course, was like, "Oh well, enjoy." But you know, it felt like if I don't make that polite, good-humoured, quiet stand, then I'm letting down the kids that come after us.
But presumably, the museum is also a place for that lady that served you the bottle of wine to come and learn more about life as well. Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and it's also, it's not just about that coming out moment. It's also, it's about that, enabling people to see themselves reflected truthfully through history, allowing ourselves to see the achievements of this wildly diverse, broad sets of communities. And it comes back to that thing, doesn't it, of to roll out the cliche of you can't be what you can't see. And we want to show how LGBTQ plus people have been intrinsically stitched through history and the impact we've made. And we want to really just sort of blow people's minds as to the possibilities of life.
Well, because I was thinking about it. I mean, as you've already mentioned, you've been editor of the Gay Times. I mean, you've been a campaigner, but now you're a curator. Now you are creating a very physical space. Tell us a little bit more about how it's going to work, because obviously the job here is to create a museum with exhibitions, with spaces devoted to different parts of the story. Bring it to life for us.
The important thing is that if we think about the word queer, there's a huge element of plasticity in it. The idea about queer is that we can be whoever we want to be and we can do whatever we want to do. Now, how that translates to our thinking in museum terms is, yes, some permanent exhibition space, evolving, but relatively fixed. But also we want to make sure that we then have flexible space within that we can bring in an endless series of guest curators and work with community co-curating as well. So we want to be able to work with community groups and expert curators in order to say, right, here's the space, here's the resources. What's the story that needs to be told? What's the story that hasn't been told? Is that something about medieval queer life? Has that been told? Is this about community activism in the 70s? Is this about the laws that the UK have exported around the country, the world via the empire? Is this about anything, any number of stories that we could tell? And this is one of the beautiful things about working within an area that is undertold and in some places is contested.
And such a rich story to discover, though, presumably.
Totally rich.
A sort of a year in modern memory that I know is a pretty pivotal one in terms of how the museum came about, because we've spoken about it, is this kind of lightning rod year of 1967, in terms of the legalization of homosexuality, in terms of generations that sort of felt this was the moment of emancipation, and those that are perhaps see that as a point in the dim and distant memory. Pick up the story for us in terms of how that has been a catalyst for everything that you're doing now.
This was central, really. I mean, first of all, one of the things that I'd push back on and challenge is that that 1967 moment is much better thought of in terms of partial decriminalization, because the age of consent was different, and actually it led to a huge rise in the number of people who were being prosecuted. So it's not as straightforward as to just say that it was a liberating moment. It was a compromise.
But it's a pivotal moment.
It was pivotal, definitely pivotal. Should have happened 10 years earlier when the Wolfenden report was actually released in 1957, but. That's a whole other issue.
Yeah, because the reason why I want you to stick with that year is because of what it means to, say, a millennial generation and what it might mean to a Gen X generation in terms of the, I guess, the poignancy and importance in your own journey of discovery and I guess how it may not feature for younger audiences in quite the same way.
Yeah, well, this moves us on very neatly, actually, to what the very first genesis was, which was in 2007, which was the 40th anniversary of the partial decriminalisation. I was editor of Gay Times magazine at that point, and I was curious to know what kind of generation gap had grown up. So we did a very unscientific study by bringing together, we brought four young men, you know, the law affected men largely. Well, the law affected men, and also Gay Times was pretty much a male audience. So that was the audience we were talking to. Four young men who hadn't yet been born in 1967, and four men who were already adults in 1967, just to foster a conversation, say, well, what do they know about each other's lives? Where are the gaps? And it turned out that two of the young men that we interviewed for this piece had never, weren't even aware that it had ever been illegal for them to love whoever they were going to love. Now, first of all, it seemed quite a shocking thing to hear, that something so profound and so impactful had kind of been lost to history. And this actually speaks directly to what it is that we're trying to do, which is to make sure that two people from, you know, 50% of those people don't lose what their roots were and what their heritage was. Now, the thing that was interesting was that the four older guys, their instant response was a little bit like they'd been slapped around the face. They were upset.
Hurt.
Mm. You know, it felt like some of the hurt from their earlier days had been kind of like magnified again. But what we did is we thought about this. And actually we said, the thing is, firstly, thank you. Didn't you do a brilliant job that these youngsters can get on with their lives without having to live on the barricades like you did? And the second thing is that if, you know, if you're not hearing about your heritage consistently within the popular culture, consistently in schools, consistently amongst your peer groups or your family or friends, then how do you know what you don't know?
Mm.
And that's the problem. You can't ask the question if you don't know the question is there.
But is there also a sense that freedoms that have been hard fought for have to be defended and have to be looked after because of the risk you might lose them again?
The way I've always thought about this is that, you know, when change comes quickly, it can also vanish very, very quickly. And I sort of think about this as we live on a very thin meniscus of history. And that meniscus could shatter at any moment. Does a meniscus shatter? Probably doesn't shatter.
I'm going to take your word for that one, Jim, I think.
That could vanish very easily, and we could very easily find ourselves under that water again, particularly with, you know, global rising populism. So it's a very dangerous moment to find ourselves in, thinking the job's been done. But actually, what this comes to is a point where we can recognize the gains, and then we have come to it with a better understanding of how to broaden that arc of inclusion as well.
But I think this also brings into full view the role of culture, the role of literature, the role of comedy. I mean, Mark Gatiss did an absolutely wonderful reading of what's called Mr. Lucas's Diaries, of what it was like to live in a now forgotten time. I mean, presumably this is a big part of the public education program of a museum, which is to bring people along by actually persuading and entertaining as well as part of that.
Well, and I think Mark was absolutely central in that entertaining piece, because he really, really brought these diaries to life. And in fact, this set of diaries, it's an extraordinary record, which are being moved into the Queer Britain collection. Millions of words from 1949 to 2007, when Mr. Lucas unfortunately was struck by a van and departed. And it documents in pooterish detail what life was like for a gay man on the margins of society, both having this weird double life of a very respectable civil service job, mixed with graphic detail about the kind of underground clubs he was going to at night, who he was meeting at Piccadilly Circus.
It's very funny, isn't it? In terms of there are as poignant, but some extremely humorous moments as part of
it. It pivots from heart-crushingly sad and scary, Mr. Lucas being blackmailed, in a couple of places, his house being turned over by people that he'd let in, you know, had come home for sexual purposes, and then ended up having some of his most precious things stolen. And he couldn't go to the police because his fear was that he would be the one that would be prosecuted.
But I suppose if it serves as a bit of a warning from history, you now have an initiative that you're running called Open Letters, which is, I suppose, a message to the future in terms of hopes and dreams about what happens next. I mean, it's a wonderful initiative, which is on your homepage, on the Queer Britain homepage, in terms of the actual letters that people are writing. Tell us a little bit about the campaign.
Well, originally it was a collaboration between Queer Britain, Levi's, and Post Office. Mm. Originally, it was intended that with Levi's, we were going to be traveling around the country, touring, collecting people's oral histories. Turns out it's not the best time to be doing that in a pandemic.
Not a good year.
We didn't really want to be doing a super spreader event if we could possibly avoid it. And so once we started talking to the Post Office, realized there was a really nice way of doing this, of actually getting people just to connect to a piece of paper and share whatever was in their heads and their hearts at this extraordinary moment in history.
Mm. And you have quite a few corporate backers, don't you? I mean Saatchi and Saatchi and others that have really got behind this. Coutts and
MNC Saatchi,
sorry about that. no offense intended. But if
I didn't correct you.
but a lot of people often sort of complain that corporations don't get it. And, you know, I was reading a statistic that 72% of the LGBTQ+ community think the way that gay people are presented in advertising, for example, is tokenistic. Is this the big move forward? Is the sort of the open letters idea something which is more authentic, more real, more true to the experience?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have thought of that as a, you know, the open letters thing I wouldn't have thought of in terms of marketing.
But you have got the Post Office and Levi's and others, MNC, Saatchi involved.
Yeah, very much so. But I mean, that's very much about access. It's about networks. It's about how do we amplify our voice. And it's also about, you know, where does power sit within the culture these days? You know, if we're going to pull off a museum as ambitious as we're working on, then we have to have good relationships with companies who are showing the right signs, and you know, we have to be willing to bring them along with us.
Mm. I mean, you say where does power sit within the culture? I mean, do you feel empowered now? I mean, do you feel that basically momentum is with you, Joe?
Yeah, I feel like we've got the wind in our sails, very much so. And actually, you know, there are some of the key moments where you realize that you're really making some headway. It's like, okay, Levi's are interested in working with us. Now they, you know, for a charity of our age, kind of extraordinary to develop a partnership in that way. We have a 3-year partnership. They've spent good slabs of their marketing budget on us, on lifting up what we're doing. If I think about, you know, what is the signal? What is a powerful signal about moving into the heart of the mainstream, but keeping our own values? Well, the Queen's Bank, you know, to work with Coutts, that has to suggest a sea change in how LGBTQ+ people are seen within the society and what our place is. And, you know, this is about us taking our place at the table.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the thing is doing it in your own way, right? Because, you know, what I sort of feel about Queer Britain is it is the sort of idea that you would expect to find in a country, I guess, that has got a good history of a certain amount of irreverence, a certain amount of individuality, a certain ability to actually, you know, create fun and identity. I suppose, is this as much celebration as it is education, do you think?
it's all of those things. It's celebration of how much we've achieved and who we are. It's a celebration of the freedom of identity. You know, it's quite often, I think, you know, there are people who argue against the ever expanding LGBTQ plus moniker. There are people who want to be able to tell you what you can and can't be. But actually, you know, the most important thing and the most exciting thing is, well, you can be anybody you want to be. But no one gets to tell you that.
And I suppose in terms of the museum itself as well, it's a story about relationships and love that you're talking about. I mean, I love that your top quote is, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. I mean, love is a hugely important part of the story that you're about to tell with the new museum.
What's wonderful is that there's very few museums that really cut so directly to the heart of what it means to be human. You know, what does it really mean to be human? It's the relationships that we hold close. It's who do we love? Who do we bring into our lives? Who are we drawn to? Who do we hold dear? And that's really the essence of it.
And your top tip for listeners is, don't let a fear of failure stop you acting. I'd rather fail than live with the knowledge that I hadn't tried for fear.
Yeah.
Explain that a little more to us.
I think that's very much about be prepared to make a mess of things. Be prepared to be the person who has gone, well, we gave it a go. Never be the person who says, I wish I had.
And I suppose this is a great entrepreneurial attitude for somebody who's involved in a startup, which is something that doesn't yet exist. But I suppose last question in terms of what people can expect and when, tell us a little bit about the timescale, the location, the actual, what we, you know, once this dreaded virus is gone, what might we be able to expect?
Well, it's going to be ramped up over the next sort of over the next few years. So we're starting off with, you know, we've been doing pop-up exhibitions, developing the infrastructure, good governance, getting fundraising up and running, all of the kind of nuts and bolts stuff that you need to do to get a really serious project off the ground. In this first iteration, it's been around pop-up exhibitions created in partnership. We're working towards 2022 opening what we're calling a meanwhile space, which is a temporary experiment.
Meanwhile space.
I know, it sounds great, doesn't it?
That'll be a smaller version, I'm presuming.
Yeah, it would be a much, much smaller, but kind of quick and dirty, and somewhere we can bring community into, donors into, and experiment with different types of exhibitions and sort of get more experience about doing this kind of work as a team. And then while we're doing that, that then gives us a place to be able to bring supporters while we then fundraise for the big ticket item, which we're working towards opening the doors on 2025, 26. I'm refreshing the business plan today, so this is right top of my mind at the moment.
And okay, so 2026, and if somebody's listening to this interview in 2021 and thinking, well, I might quite like to support that, I might like to try and get involved. I mean, in terms of the why this matters now, last thought on what you'd like listeners to take away from this interview.
I'd like listeners to understand that whoever they are, they can be a part of this, whether they are LGBTQ or not. Because this is about everybody's stories, that there are ways that everybody can help, whether that's about helping reach through their companies that they work for, whether it's about joining our membership scheme and making a, you know, small monthly donation of whatever they can afford, whether it's about you know, the bigger ticket donors who are able to come and really make a big impact on an individual level. It's about evangelizing for us, It's about getting involved in the research projects that we're doing. It's about coming to the exhibitions that we're working on. It's about signing up for the newsletter at www.queerbritain.org.uk.
Don't worry, we're going to give it a link, Jay. But listen, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But Jay, thank you so much for joining us on Changemakers. And what a story it's been. And I suppose that is the message, isn't it? Be a part of it and make the difference. But thanks to Jay Galliano, the creator and the curator of Queer Britain. I think we've really heard such a wonderful story about celebrating lives through empowerment, creating a place as exciting as the people, stories and ideas it explores, and completing that sense, that wonderful romantic sense of the nation's family tree by empowering everyone to come out of the margins. Do join me next time on Changemakers.